Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Pat Walsh, and we're really happy that you came this evening to welcome Alexei with his first novel, Touch. Alexei was born and raised in Kitchener, Ontario, and currently lives in Ithaca, New York, with his wife and two daughters. He holds both Canadian and American citizenship. Many a group that seeks out upcoming talented authors have lauded his work and tag him as an author to watch. His short story, Trapline, was awarded the 2008 Narrative Prize and named to the Best American Short Stories of 2009. List of 100 other distinguished stories of 2008. His short stories, Touch and The Adjuster, were also selected for special attention in the 2008 Pushcart Anthology. In addition to being published in the U.S., it is available in Canada and in the U.K., and soon to be available in France, the Netherlands, Israel, Korea, and Brazil, which is, that's really something. To start out with, my favorite, except for the cover, too, my favorite sort of thing that draws you in was this comment by Mary Lawson, an author herself. It chills you to the bone and then warms your heart. I think that's a wonderful thing to say about someone's work. So let's welcome him.
First of all, I just want to say thank you to Tattered Cover for having me. I hope that you don't take for granted what it means to have an excellent independent bookstore in your community. Not every community has one, and those that don't have it have a real lack of vacuum in the communities, and it's something that's very important. I should say before I start that Touch is not a comedy. I, however, am charming and handsome, so if you don't enjoy this tonight, it's totally you, not me. I'm going to talk a little bit about the book, read from the book, probably longer than you'd like, and then be happy to answer questions. Touch did start as a short story. At the time I wrote it, though, I knew I always wanted it to be a novel, but I wasn't ready to write it as a novel yet. When I wrote Touch as a short story, I'd only been writing seriously for a very short period of time, and I just didn't think I was ready to make it into a novel. And when I finished that story, which now is a good portion of the first chapter, I really didn't have a sense of what I was doing was any good or not until I heard my wife crying. And really, maybe a month before I wrote that story, I decided I was going to give serious writing a real shot. And we decided to hire a babysitter to come to the house 2 days a week for 2 hours. At the time, I was a stay-at-home dad, and both my daughters were young. I think my daughters were 2 and 4. Maybe they were 1 and 3. And most of my day involved, you know, Cheerios, naps, diapers. And we lived in suburban St. Louis, which was great because my in-laws lived there and they're lovely people, but it was also suburban St. Louis. So it was the kind of place where I remember I was out one day with my, at the time, only had one daughter with me, and I had a woman stop me. She had three children. She said to me, "I think it's so brave that you're out with your daughter like this." So it was maybe not a community that sort of geared to the idea of a stay-at-home dad trying to become a writer. So hiring a babysitter was a big step for us. Money was tight, and it was 20 or 25 bucks. And I remember the first time I went out, I went to a coffee shop, and I sat down, and for an hour and 50 minutes, I was frantically surfing the internet, procrastinating, and not writing. And I got home, and the babysitter does that thing that they do where they hold out their hand and they expect you to give them money, real money. And I thought, oh, I have to pay you for me to not write. And that was the moment where I thought, you know, maybe I should actually write as opposed to procrastinating. And I remember I finished the story and I gave it to my wife, and I was remodeling the basement. I went downstairs and I think I put a coat of spackle on in the bathroom, and I came back upstairs about 25 minutes later, and I come back up and my wife is sitting on the couch and she's crying. And I think, oh crap. And I say, what's wrong? And she holds up the story and she says, you know, it's the story. And again, I think, oh crap. But she liked it, so I take that as a good sign. She's kind of always my sort of canary in the coal mine. If she cries something, that's usually a good sign. Touch is set, runs from about 1870 through World War II, and it's set in a logging town, a boom town gone bust, the kind of place that's so cold the schoolhouse thermometer breaks from the cold, the kind of place where the water freezes so fast it can trap the drowning. And it's a book that is about memory. It's about, the narrator is an Anglican pastor who's coming home on the eve of his mother's death. But it's also about the narrator's grandfather, a man who walked across the country, settled the town of Saugerment, stole a dog from a witch, sort of an epic figure. But he's also a man who leaves this town and then comes back later to raise his wife from the dead. So it's a book that's very much balances back and forth between sort of a very tangible, real, physical world, and also one of magic and monsters and witches. I think what you probably need to know from the section I'm going to read is that the narrator, Stefan, is, again, he's an Anglican pastor. He's got a wife and children of his own. But in the scene I'm reading from, he is around 10 years old. His sister is named Marie, and his father is the foreman of the logging company, which is a position that he was elevated to when a log crushed his hand. You might need to know more than that, but that's all I'm going to tell you. So you're on your own. If that's not enough, I think that should do it. Even though we wanted to be with my father in the cuts during the summers, the winters were better, because at least then we had him to ourselves. School days, he took to the mill, filing blades, checking the books, helping the assistant foreman, Pearl, tend to the horses. But he was home when we were, sitting at the stove at night, listening with us as my mother, a former schoolteacher at the Saugerment schoolhouse, read from her books. He carved small wooden toys for Marie, a rough horse, a whistle, using his destroyed hand to pin the block of wood to the table. Mostly, though, he told us stories. I know that out in the cuts he was a different man. He had to be. He kept the men's respect, and in turn, they kept the saw blades humming through green wood. While their axes cut smiles into pines and stripped branches from fallen trees, while they wrapped chains around the logs, my father moved through the woods, yelling, talking, making them laugh, taking the end of a saw when it was needed. He pushed them hard, and when they pushed back, he came home with bruises, an eye swollen shut, scabs on his knuckles. He made them listen. At home, he was gentle. At night, he told us stories about his father, how Jeannot found gold and settled Saugerment, and then the long winter that followed the bust. He told us about the Qualiput and Amaguak, the trickster wolf god, about the Loup Garou and the blood-drinking Adlet, about all of the monsters and witches of the woods. He told us about the other kinds of magic that he stumbled across in the cuts, how the sawdust grew wings and flew down men's shirts like mosquitoes, how one tree picked itself up and walked away from the sharp teeth of the saw. He told us about splitting open a log to find a fairy kingdom, about clearing an entire forest with one swing of his axe, about the family of trees he'd found twisted together, pushing toward the sky, braided in love. Our favorite story, however, the story that we always asked him to retell, was about the year he finally convinced our mother to marry him. The last time I remember him telling the story was the spring before I turned 10. "Every man had been thrown but me and Pearl, Gasser," he said. "Old Pearl?" Marie giggled, thinking of Pearl as I thought of him, riding in the middle of the float with his close gray hair bristling crazily from his scalp, yellowed long underwear peeking from the cuffs of his shirt. My father had told the story so many times that Marie probably could have recounted it word for word by then, but like me, like our mother, she still laughed and clapped. "Old Pearl! Old Pearl!" my father roared, his teeth flashing. "Old Pearl wasn't always old," he yelled happily. "Old Pearl could sink any man who would laugh at you while he spun the log out from under your feet." "And Mrs. Gasser was happy to tell you about it," my mother said. "She was happy as winter berries watching him dunk the boys." My mother smiled at this. She always smiled. Log rolling in Saugerment was a tradition, Every year, the entire town came down to the river the day before the float. They carried blankets and baskets full with chicken, roasted onions and potatoes, bread, blueberry pies, strawberry wine. My father, and before him, Foreman Martin, would roll out a few barrels of beer, and the men took to the water. They spun logs, a man on either end, turning the wood with their feet faster and faster, stopping and spinning the other way until one, or sometimes both, pitched into the cold water to raucous cheers from the banks. Pearl won ever since I could remember, my father said. He'd never been unseated, but I had to win. He slapped the worn pine table with his mangled hand and winked at my mother. Oh, your mother was a clever one. He stood up from the table and hooked his arm around her waist, pulling her close to him and looking over her shoulder at Marie and me. She still is. He kissed her then, and it surprised me to see my mother's cheeks redden. Before she pushed him away, she whispered something into his ear, and he reddened as well, pausing a moment to watch her take the plates from the table. Papa, Marie said, demanding more. But you know all this already. She married me, he said, turning back to us and waving his hand. And here you are. Papa, Marie said again, shaking her finger at him like our schoolmarm. Tell it right, I said. He smiled and leaned over the top of his chair. She wouldn't marry me. But Mama, Marie asked, why didn't you love Papa? My father stopped and looked at my mother. This was not part of the story. Why didn't you love me, he said. You asked every girl in Sagamet to marry you, my mother answered. But I only asked them once, he said, turning back to Marie. Your mother I asked every day. All of the men had asked her to marry them, even some of the ones who were already married, but I kept asking. Every day for 3 years I called in her at the boarding house, and every day I asked her to marry me. And she always said no. Marie reached out and cupped the withered fingers of my father's bad hand in her two hands. He sat down next to her. Mama, she asked again, why didn't you love Papa? I always loved him, sweetheart, she said, pouring hot water from the stove into the dish tub. She leaned in toward the steam, letting it wash across her face. I just didn't know it yet. So I kept asking her to marry me until one day she didn't say no. What did she say? Marie could not stop herself. She said the day she'd marry me was the day I got Pearl into the water. I thought it was a safe bet, my mother said. Your father never could seem to stay dry. My father was leaning back in his chair now, staring at the moon through the window. He'd taken his hand back from Marie, and he rubbed the fingers of his good hand across the back of the bad as if it ached. I wanted to hear about his triumph, how that was the year the log had spun so fast he could not see his feet, and how it was not until he heard a splash and a roar from the banks of the river that he knew he'd finally dunked Pearl of Gusur. I wanted to hear him describe the feel of the cold water when he dove from the log and swam to the bank, the river dripping from his clothes as he walked to my mother. I wanted to see the wink he gave us when he said that our priest, Father Hugo, was asleep with drink at the barrels of beer. I wanted to hear how Father Earl, who'd arrived from Ottawa only the day before and who was Anglican and younger than my father, performed the wedding right then and there on the bank of the Sagamet. But before he could tell us that, before he could tell us how he had to leave the next morning for the float, and how he ran home all the way from Havershand, running to his wife, I asked him, "Do you miss it? Do you miss the float?" He looked at me for a moment as if he'd not heard my question, and then my mother spoke. "You and Marie wash up now. Get ready for bed." As I rose from the table, he stopped me. He raised his ruined hand, the fingers curled like a claw. "I miss it," he said. He did not tell many stories for the next few weeks, and then when the snow finally melted enough for the men to take out their saws and axes and get into the woods, my father pushed them terribly, as if he knew how bad the coming winter would be. He kept them working from dawn to dusk with not a day's break until the 1st of September, when the trees were stacked and lined beside the mill. So it's interesting. I did a pretty extensive tour in April and some things over the summer, and I'm doing a bunch of festivals in the fall. And as I've been reading, I keep finding myself coming back to sections that emphasize the human over the supernatural. And perhaps this is only interesting to me, but since I have the microphone, you're going to have to listen to it anyway. I guess it's interesting because I've gotten on sort of a lot of attention for some of the magic in the book and what I've been calling mythical realism, which might seem like I'm sort of parsing a term a little bit, but I think when you think of magical realism, you're really thinking of Marquez. You're thinking of Eastern European traditions. You're thinking of Central and South American traditions. And those forms of magical realism are very firmly rooted in landscape and tradition. And those are not the landscape and tradition that we have in North America. And so what I do, and I've been calling mythical realism, I think some of the difference is that I'm coming at it from sort of an oblique angle, that in the story, magic is ongoing, that has the weight of reality. that it is woven throughout the story as opposed to just sort of dropped in or dropped out of the story. I think that if you take magical realism, the forms that you have from Central and South America or from European traditions, and you map them over our own landscape, you end up with a palimpsest where sort of those traditions and cultures sort of ghostly show through in a way that is interesting, but is not what I was trying to do. But it's interesting because, again, critically, a lot of attention has been paid to some of sort of that magic. But ultimately, I think the book is a love story. And I would argue, and I've said this a bunch and enough that my friends sort of roll their eyes when I say this, I think that there's really only two things you can write about, and that's love and death. And I heard a poet say that once, and he said that he told his wife that. And she said, well, yes, but you only write about love because you really want to write about death. And I feel like I'm the other way around. I only write about death because I really want to write about love. Which again is oblique, but I have the microphone, so I think part of that comes though from just sort of the idea that I think part of the reason I want to write a love story is that in some ways it's a love story about people, but it's also sort of a love story about stories. And this book is very much about storytelling and myths, and for me, and I think for a lot of people who are readers and writers, at some point sort of reading saves your life. There's a moment where you come across a book that sort of changes everything for you. And I think that that's incredibly important to remember. I think that we sometimes forget how important art is. And I believe that art elevates humanity and that reading is fundamentally important, and fiction particularly so, that we read because it helps us figure out who we are as humans. And I think that's why we tell stories. And I think that's one reason why fiction will never become unimportant. I think as long as there will always be a child out there who comes across a book that changes his or her life. And I think that's why we write. And I think that's why we read, because at some point we've come across that book. And if we haven't come across that book, we read because we know that it's out there waiting for us. So I'm going to read another shortish section. Well, short to me may feel longer to you, about 10 minutes or so, and I'll be happy to take questions. This is picking up just a few pages later, and it's winter. I always feel so awkward with the taking the drink thing, and there's nothing I can do, and I'm always waiting for the day where I take this drink and then choke on it in front of a crowd, and I'm afraid that I'm going to do that and then actually like asphyxiate, and everybody's going to think it's part of my little shtick and nobody's going to do anything, and I'm just going to die.
I understand, because
it's okay. There's no way to do it. There's no way to sort of drink without it being horribly awkward, but sort of my life, I guess. Sundays before dinner, we usually went down to the river. That Sunday, however, my mother stayed in the house to finish her baking, so only my father came down with us, carrying his and Marie's skates slung over the hockey stick he rested on his shoulder. With the cold, which had shattered the schoolhouse's glass thermometer the week before, even my father wore a scarf over his face to protect him. My mother had swaddled Marie and me with so many layers of clothing that we had trouble with the steps. Still, the cold seeped through the layers like water, and we were eager to skate and warm ourselves a little. Down at the river, we sat on the packed snow at the banks, and my father helped Marie with her skates. He tied her laces and sent her off on the river. As he tied his own laces, she skated slowly toward the tip of the channel, pushing away from us with timid steps, like a newborn moose with shivering legs. The sun was already setting, and I could feel the temperature falling away and getting colder, if such a thing was even possible. I had my head bent down over my skates and was pulling the laces tight, eager to take my stick and join the other boys playing shinny, when my father suddenly jumped from the snow along the bank, one skate still unlaced. He screamed Marie's name, skates chewing the frozen water, flying toward the thin ice at the confluence of the two rivers. There was just a dark hole where Marie had broken through the ice and disappeared. Other men raced behind my father, but he was the first to the open water, screaming her name. For a moment, he stopped at the edge of the fissure. Suddenly, we all saw her, gasping, bobbing, taking a last breath at the surface of the water, too cold or too scared to even scream. And as I reached the water, I saw my sister's eyes lock on to my father. He dove into the water, and then they were gone. I hesitated at the edge, staring at the water, surprised at how smooth it was. Pearl grabbed my shoulder roughly. No, he said, as if he were holding me back, and I realized that I'd not even thought of following my father in. The black water in the hole that Marie's fall had opened up started icing even as Pearl held my arm. The men yelled for rope, but then, not willing to wait, they linked arms, Pearl the first one into the breach. I could see the shock on his face at the first touch of the water, It was a minute at most before the men hauled him back from the water, the skin on his hands gone white from the cold. He could not stand when they took him out, his legs shaking uselessly beneath him. The sun seemed to have fallen from the sky, pulling the temperature down with it. In the dark, I could barely see the hole in the ice freezing back over, like a mouth that had briefly yawned open and was now closing again. Even though it was too late, another man and then another went into the river, reaching beneath the water to feel for my father and Marie. As the last man was pulled from the water, the ice almost sealed shut around his legs, as if the river wanted one more. It was Father Earl who brought my mother down to the river, and she found me sitting around the bonfire on the bank near the men with the blue chattering lips. Boiling sap and a burning pine log popped, sending up a shower of sparks. A few embers floated out over the river before dying in the night. Later, there were other wives and mothers, quiet murmurs, Pearl sitting beside me, changing to dry clothes, but crying. And then, finally, my mother and I turning home. And I'm going to skip a page or so, and you'll live. The cold in Sagamet can break you. The winter that Marie fell through the ice was that sort of winter. What little warmth there'd been in October and November dropped completely away from us, and even with a constant fire in the stove, my mother and I took to wearing our overcoats in the house, hats and mittens to bed. Though there were no bodies, there was a funeral, and afterward my mother spoke little to the women who brought plates of food, little to my great-aunt Rebecca and great-uncle Franklin, my aunt Julia and her husband Lawrence, their daughter Virginia, little to Miss Cassur, to Pearl, little to Father Hugo or to Father Earl, who visited us even though we were not in his flock. She did not speak to me even when I lifted my father's axe from the wooden pegs over the stone lintel of the doorway and took it out behind the house. I split wood every morning, and the sound of the axe on the wood seemed to linger, floating through our house long after I'd returned home from school. Every evening I sharpened the blade, the rasp of the stone on metal making my mother shiver. The winter punished us into December. Snow fell hard, a roof creaking until angry winds beat the white dust onto the ground. The same winds cleared a great swath of snow from the Sagamet, until finally, between Christmas and New Year's, the sun came out and the men and children, bundled against the cold, took their skates down to the river again. Except for the whip of the wind and the crackling of wood in the stove, our house was quiet. The knock on the door sounded like a shot. Pearl led us to the river, helping my mother down the snow-crested steps cut into the hill next to the log chute, holding her arm as we walked across the ice to the small circle of men. The ice was smooth and clean after a month of scouring from the wind. The hands were not touching. Even through the plate of frozen water covering them, we saw clearly that little more than the width of an axe blade separated my father's two hands from my sister's one. His mangled fingers on one hand, the smooth alabaster fingers on the other hand, all stretched toward Marie's small hand. The ice like glass above their hands, thickened as we tried to look further out to see the rest of their bodies and their faces. The lines blurred, only shadows, dark shapes. There was talk of axes, of chopping at the ice, but my mother forbade it, as if they'd suggested pulling my father and Marie from their graves, and then the men left, gliding away from us on their skates. Pearl touched me on the back and headed toward the bank, leaving my mother and me over the ghosts of our family. As the sun dropped below the peak of the hill, we turned from the ice and trudged back up the steps, holding the side of the log chute for balance. Thanks, and I'll be happy to take questions. Questions? Yes.
One of the first questions I heard in a workshop I was in was, how do you know a story is a short story, and how do you know it's a novel? And you managed to do both with one tale. How did you know you could bridge that gap?
The really flip answer that I like to give when what's the difference between a short story and a novel is that a novel's longer. But I realize that's not a useful answer, and I'm clearly just stalling for time here. You know, that's one of those questions that's really impossible to answer, and the real answer is it's kind of like pornography. You know it when you see it. I think that, though, probably the more helpful answer is that when you have a short story and there are characters and things that you want to chase, but you realize that there are too many rabbit holes to go down, that may be a sign that you have a novel. And there's a certain discipline in short story writing that's required. And there's a very famous phrase called, you know, killing your darlings. And the idea being that just because you love something and just because it's good doesn't mean it's good for the story or for the novel. And more what that means is that sometimes you can write something that's really beautiful and fantastic and it just doesn't fit in the space. But when we're talking about a short story, sometimes what that means is that there may be a character who's incredibly fascinating or something that really is really interesting. But if you follow that, then you're sort of expanding the scope of the short story. I know there are authors who write sort of these glorious messes of, you know, these novels where, you know, every character is followed and there's so many tangled things that don't get followed and resolved. And I don't particularly love that kind of writing and I don't particularly love that kind of reading. I've read books like that are fabulous, but it's just not, it's not who I am. So when I was writing the story, I realized that there were things that I wanted to follow up on and characters who I was very interested in, that just didn't fit in the space of that story. And I knew that if I tried to chase them at that moment, that I wasn't a good enough writer to write the book I wanted to write. And again, I'm not really joking when I say that if my wife cries, that usually means I have something good, which is really handy because I think that most writers, I don't think have a great sense of what they're doing is good or not. Once it's been a while, I can go back and say, oh, this is good, this isn't. But usually on any given day, I finish the day and think, I am the greatest living writer. Everything I do is fabulous. And then I come back the next day and I read it and I think, oh, God. that doesn't really hold. And so the problem is that, you know, the day I write it, it's the greatest thing ever. And the next day, it's the worst thing ever. So it's really nice having somebody I can hand it to. And she can say it's good or it's not good. The problem is that because my wife's not a writer, she can say it's good or it's not good, but she can never really tell me why. The flip side being that if you have friends who are writers, they can never tell you if it's good or not good. They can just tell you what's wrong with it, which is sort of endemic to the format. The basic premise of a workshop is what's wrong with this story. And sometimes the answer is nothing. Sometimes the answer is you could have written a different story, but this story as it is works. So it's nice. I'm sorry. I give these really long tangential answers where I go off and by the time I'm done, I don't remember what I was asked, the original question was, which in this case was how do you tell between a short story and a novel and how do you write a short story that it can also be a novel? So that was the question, right? Okay, God. I'm so far removed from the question now that you might be asking me for restaurant recommendations and I just totally screwed the answer up. Anyway, so when I wrote the story, I knew that there was more to it, but I also knew that if I chase that, I would screw it up. But when I wrote the novel in an earlier, you know, sort of one of the first drafts of the novel, there are two extant short stories that I culled from the novel as short stories and published that are not in the novel. And it's funny, when I gave them to my agent, and I was chatting with his assistant, and he said, he's like, why aren't these in the book? And they didn't fit. They weren't right for the book. I mean, I think they were, I have enough distance that I don't think I'm the greatest living writer at this exact moment, but I think they were very solid pieces and they were good. They didn't belong to that world. And at some point, you can't fit everything in. I mean, the analogy I use, which is a terrible analogy, but I do most of the cooking at home, is that it's kind of like putting leftovers in a Tupperware container. There's just a limit to how much you can fit in over there. And if you put too much in it and you put the cover on, you get all that goops, spill out the sides. And, you know, if that's what you like, that's great, but that's not what I want in my novels. I like to fit in that container. And a container, a short story is a different size container than a novel. So, did I even come close to answering your question?
Absolutely.
All right, sorry. Yeah.
My question is, was there a particular image or nugget that you saw that turned you to the short story initially? That whole image of looking through the eyes strong and so visual, was that the kind of image that brought you to the story?
Yeah. Thank you. So the question is, and I'm repeating this not for the sake of the people who are standing right in front of me, but because it's being recorded, is sort of, was there an original image that brought me to the story? And the question is, what you asked, was it the sort of image that I just read from of the daughter and father trapped under the ice? And the answer is yes. In fact, it was a version of that particular image. I was struck by the image of just a girl trapped under the ice. And, as a father, one of the things that happens when you have kids is all of a sudden you realize that the world is full of very, very sharp things that go fast. And it becomes a very dangerous looking place. And so there's a lot of ways to be worried about the health of your children. And the beauty of having two is that, you know, you have a spare. I'm glad you laughed. I'm so glad you laughed, because that could have gone, that's a joke that could have gone so poorly. I'm very glad you laughed at that. I've occasionally made that joke and just been greeted by just sort of angry looks. And I've just, you know, I'm always, yeah, that's why my wife doesn't like to let me out in public. I was just haunted by the image of what it would mean to have somebody that you desperately loved so close to you and yet be unable to help them in any way. And it's not enough to have somebody die, to lose somebody, but have them, that loss then be there haunting you, and to know that they were within reach. And so I start with that image of this girl trapped on the ice. And I got to the moment when I was writing when she fell through the ice, and I thought, oh, this is not the sort of father who would stand on the ice. And I don't believe that your characters make you do anything. My characters do what I make them do. If I want them to do a polka, they're going to do the polka. You know, if I want them to cross the street, they're going to cross the street. But the character I had written was not a father who could have stayed there. I could have gone back and rewritten him to be the kind of man who would have hesitated, who would have watched him die. But he's, as written, and I liked that character. I thought there was some value to that. He was not a man who could watch her. And so I got to the point, I thought, he's a man who can do nothing other than to go through the ice. But it says something that the narrator doesn't even think about it, that he hesitates. And that's something that, of course, you know, ripples throughout the story. And then once they're both, you know, I had the father and the daughter through the ice, again, sort of that question of sort of what does it mean to be so close, and what does it mean for the survivors, for the son who becomes the narrator of the story, and the mother, to know that the father sacrificed himself so quickly and so willingly and came so close, but ultimately failed, did not reach his daughter. I would say most of the things I write start with some sort of an image or a line. I usually have a sense of what the end will be. I usually know what the beginning is. I have a few scenes along the way. But it's sort of like driving from, you know, we're in Denver, driving from Denver to Chicago and knowing three cities along the way. You just have to figure out how to get to those cities still. And sometimes you get in part of the way and you think, you know what, screw Chicago, I'm going to New York. So, but usually I have a sense of where it's ending. In fact, the novel, I'm almost finished now, my new novel, I've known the last scene from the very beginning, and it's going right to that scene, and there's no question of that. Now, there are things in the middle that I hadn't planned out. There are plenty of writers who like to outline. I'm not one of those kind of writers, and everybody's process is different, and there's no right or wrong. In fact, when I teach writing, one of the things I usually try to talk about with the student is what is the process that works for them. And the one thing I can tell you, the only one I can tell you that's wrong is no, you do not write best the night before when you're under deadline and you've got to stay up all night. That is the only answer that's incorrect. But every other answer, there's no right or wrong for process. But my process is not one of outlining. It just doesn't work well for me. So, other questions? Yes. Yeah. Very quickly. It was not a lot of time. But the reality is that writing is not about waiting for the muse to strike. I worked as a journalist for a while, and I was not a very good one. I should be clear about this. I was a very good writer. I was a terrible journalist because I didn't like asking hard questions. I actually worked in Eagle County for a while, and one of my jobs at one point was to basically call the CEO of Vail Resorts every single week and ask him if the rumors were true that he was getting fired this week. And that gets old, I will tell you. That gets old. He was a nice guy, but at some point, you know, he'd pick up the phone and he'd start yelling at me before I asked the question. So I did not like asking hard questions. But one of the things you learn being a journalist is that if you are not done your piece by whatever time you go to press, you get fired. That if you're not done the piece, there's a big blank space in the paper. And so you lose that need to have, you know, the glass of wine and the curtains and the candles and, you know, the music and all that sort of stuff. And I really firmly believe that most of writing is about getting your butt in a chair. That if you wait for the muse to strike, you won't be there when the muse shows up. That to be there for inspiration, to be there for those moments of magic, you need to already be in the chair and writing. I need to be slogging through the hard stuff to get there. But no, 2 hours twice a week was not a lot of time, which is one of the reasons why you know, I decided to go for an MFA and try and rearrange my life so I had more time to write. I'm definitely, I can write 8 hours in a row. That was a loud toilet. If you didn't hear that on the recording, it was just, trust me, that was a loud toilet. I can write 8 hours in a row, which is great. But I learned very quickly. I'd go out and, you know, really, I'm cheap. I'm perfectly happy to pay $5 for my Venti decaf mocha frappuccino light. And yeah, that's actually what I order, and it's embarrassing. And when they ask me to, you know, when I'm in line and they say, "Can I get you a drink?" I always walk over to say it because I don't like calling that out loud. But I'm also the same guy who I will go so far out of my way not to pay that $2 fee at another bank's ATM. So to pay somebody $20 a week, $20, I mean, to pay somebody $20 for me to not write wasn't happening. So I got really good at sort of getting going. I'm also, though, one of the things that I'm thankful for is I'm not a particularly tortured artist. I take my writing very, very seriously. I don't take myself particularly seriously. And usually by the time I'm ready to sit down, I have a sense of what I'm doing, and so it goes quickly. That being said, I write full-time, writing full-time now. I have plenty of days where pretty much what I do is check Facebook. I don't have, and not every day is wonderfully productive, but I do try to be productive every day. And some of that is about sort of sacrificing the fun things. There are times where I have given up things to write. When I was in grad school, and as an aside, MFAs can be great. They're not for everybody. There are good things and bad things about MFAs. It provided me with time to write, and it gave me an opportunity I might not otherwise have had. But when I was in my MFA program, I was the only one with kids. And I didn't go out that often. And when I went out, and it was 11 o'clock, and I went home, and people said, "Why are you going home? It's 11 o'clock. I said, "Because I'm writing tomorrow. My kids don't care what time I go to bed. They're still getting up at 6, and I've still got to write tomorrow. I can't take a nap. If I take a nap, it means I don't get to write." And, you know, I like the people I went to school with. I gave up a lot of social stuff for that. But more than anything, writing is about getting your butt in the chair, getting the words on the page. It's not about sitting around and waiting for genius to strike. It's really about hard work. Now, that hard work, it's a hell of a lot more fun than any other job I've ever had. It's a great gig, and I really enjoy it. But there's a big difference between wanting to be a writer and wanting to write. And the moment that you make that realization, the moment you realize that you can't be a writer unless you're writing, is sort of the moment where really you're moving towards on the path to being a writer. So I give such verbose answers, and I can't help it. I love the sound of my own voice, I guess. But are there other questions? I'm happy to just ramble, I guess.
About
yeah.
The logging and the flow. And the,
yes.
Are you familiar with that before the book, or did you have to research
that? Absolutely not. I'm actually shockingly handy given how incompetent I am. But no, I grew up in Canada, but I grew up in basically a college town. It was a university town, and we had heat, we had running water, all that kind of stuff. I did some research. I will say though that logging to Canadians is sort of like cowboys are to Americans, that it is part of sort of the DNA, in a sense that you'd have to do some research if you're riding a Western, but we all kind of know what it looks like to ride a horse, sort of thing. So there's some of that. My philosophy on research is that this is a personal thing. Everybody's different on this. I try to do just the barest amount of research so that what I write rings true. If I do more than that, I end up writing a book report, which is not particularly interesting. And I tend to try to create worlds that are sort of whole cloth, that are their own places. I think that it gives you more space. I write fiction. The beauty of writing fiction is you get to make stuff up. And I also think that if you do too much research, you end up writing nonfiction. And I think people read nonfiction to be taught, and they read fiction to learn. And that's a pretty important distinction. I think people read nonfiction to be taught, and they read fiction to learn. And I'm sure if there was a nonfiction writer standing beside me, they'd punch me. But I think that they're very different forms. And I think for me, I do write nonfiction, But when I'm writing nonfiction, it's different. It's very different. I do use some of the same structure and other things, but there's a big difference between the two. But it's also, you give yourself a real freedom as a fiction writer if you make things up. I had a story in The Atlantic maybe 2 years ago, and a friend of mine had a story in the same issue. And she, my town was actually a town set in Colorado that I made up the name of the town, and my fact-checking was really easy because there are no facts in the story. My friend used the name of a real town. And every day she would call me swearing and angry at the fact checker, who would call her and say, you know, there's actually not a stop sign on that street. It's lights. Or no, the coffee shop is on the other side. That store went out of business in 1974. And the thing is that the name of the town didn't really matter. There are some times where it matters, but not usually. And I will tell you that in general, if you use a real place in your fiction, somebody is going to be upset about it because it won't be the real place that they know, no matter how accurate you are. There are times when using real things is great, but there are other times when it's sort of part of a writer's toolbox is understanding that every choice you make opens some doors and closes others. And for me personally, I like that freedom of being able to sort of have the world be the way I want it.
Listening to you read, it seems very clean, it's kind of strong, it's very clear, but it has a certain lyricism to it. Could you talk about some of the authors that perhaps have influenced you, that you read a lot?
Sure. So the question was, why are you so fabulous? And the question was that my writing is both clean and spare and yet also lyrical, and sort of what are some of my influences. Growing up, some of the first authors I read that were sort of literary authors were Margaret Atwood, Michael Ondaatje, who have some of that same styles, Salman Rushdie. It's interesting. I'm not sure that... I don't know that I can say these people are my influences. In some ways they are. I think that I'd like to hope I've developed my own writing style. Currently, I've recently, I read really widely. You know, growing up, I read everything. My parents read a lot. I don't think particularly well, but we had probably 3,000, 4,000 books in our house, and I was never censored with what I could read, which, you know, good things and bad things. There were some books that, I mean, I think I remember reading is it Jacqueline Collins? Is that a real person?
Yes.
I remember reading a Jacqueline Collins book when I was 12 or so. And boy, that was... There's children here. Yeah, it was steamy. It's a good word. But boy, I remember reading that book thinking, where has this book been hiding? And I read a lot of junk, but also the thing about reading widely is that I think as a writer, you need to read widely. If you only read books that you like and you only read in a certain vein, it's crippling. I mean, you need to understand what other people are doing push against it. When I meet young writers and I say, you know, they say, well, I want to be a writer, and I say, what do you read? And they say, I don't read. I more or less say to them, if you don't read, you'll never be a writer. When you ask a writer if they read and they say no, they're either lying or they're a bad writer. There's only two options there. There's no such thing as a good writer who doesn't read. And I'd be any writer who can prove me differently, I'd be happy to meet. And more or less, I can tell you that if they're coming to me and they're a writer and they say they don't read, and they really don't read, their books probably stink. It's interesting. Since I've started writing seriously, my reading has changed a lot. I read less for pleasure. It's harder for me to read a book and sort of forget to lose myself into it. The structure of the book, sort of the craft of it, is something that's readily apparent to me. And often I see the flaws, or I see how it's constructed, or I see things about it that the writer, I think, would hope that you would not notice. So it's rare that I lose myself in a book. And I will say that the books I tend to lose myself in now are not particularly good, because I'm reading them, they're purely for pleasure, and I know going in that they will be flawed. It doesn't bother me that there are things about them that are problematic. But I actually just finished this morning or afternoon Jennifer Egan's Visit from the Goon Squad, which was excellent. I just bought and I'm starting Tinkers, so I figured I might as well sort of work my way backwards with Pulitzer Prize winners, although I can stop after this since I've read the other ones. Growing up was really interesting. Growing up in Canada, there's a lot of Canadian fiction that doesn't cross the border, but a lot of U.S. fiction does. And so I've read widely from American fiction, but there are also Canadian writers who probably are not widely read here. And now that I say that, I, of course, can't think of any of their names. Alice Munro. Yes, of course, Alice Munro. Some of the British authors like Graham Greene, Robertson Davies, there are authors who are now out of fashion in Canada. It's interesting, you know, I've lived in the States for the last I've actually lived in the States about half my life, although I still think of Canada as home. Well, it's funny. I've actually lived in the U.S., I think, now longer than I've lived in Canada. But it's hard. I have to work very hard to read up on Canadian authors. And one of the nice things about having a Canadian publisher is I can more or less say, give me a stack of books, which is nice. It's actually one of the coolest things about being a writer is you can just sort of make them give you free books. Yeah. So, yes.
Have you written anything for your daughters or gotten the question, is there anything?
I have. I actually wrote, I'm sorry, the question is, have I written anything for my daughters? So my daughters are 7 and 9 now, and I actually just wrote a picture book for them, which actually my agent just sent out. So I don't know. I have no clue how that works, so I'm a little skeptical about it being sold, but I think it's good, so it'd be fun. I actually am going to write, I have a middle grade book I'd like to write and a YA book I'd like to write, which seems fun and quick to me. And again, sort of the beauty of not being a tortured writer is that I'm not going to spend 3 years doing that. It seems like a sort of a fun interlude. They have asked. I wrote this picture book for them, and I can't draw, so it's just the words. And I read it to my oldest daughter, and she started crying. And then, it was nice. I was actually sort of the same thing. I was like, I felt kind of bad, but I was also like, yes. And then I read it to my youngest daughter, and she started crying. And then when my wife came home, I said, can I read it to you? And my daughters were like, no, read it. And so, they said. And then my wife said, well, you know, are you crying because you're sad? And my daughter said, it's tears of joy. So I don't really care if it gets published. That made me happy. Yeah, thank you. But, you know, in some level, I mean, I think everything I write is for my kids. I mean, everything I write is, I do think the themes that obsess me are sort of family and obligation and the way that our desire can be at odds or in concert with our obligations. I'm fascinated with the question of love, which, as I said earlier, sort of flippantly means I write about death a lot. So in some ways, everything I write is for the people I love. That being said, I'm sure as hell not letting my kids read this book yet. First of all, because I think they'd bore the pants off of them. Second of all, because I think it would probably give them nightmares. Any other questions? Thank you so much for coming out, and thank you again to the Tatter Cover. I think I'm legally obligated to say that books are on sale, and I'm happy to sign them.
Yes.
So thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.